John White joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. For me, when I was a kid, it was Long Acres that was the place to be. So that's an interesting pie story there. I wanted to weigh in on this Gold Cup at Belmont. And I was texting with a friend within seconds after the race because he had texted me and said, what do you think? And before they even put up the objection or inquiry, and I said, well, I said, I thought that Vino Rosso ran a good race, and he seems to be a curlin improving with age like a fine wine. But I added in my text to him, I said, there could be a DQ here. And I said that without obviously having seen the head on. And what I then also texted to him, because he texted back and said, really? And I said, yes, might be DQ. I said, in New York, they pretty much let them play more than anywhere these days, but this could be a DQ. So I was on the same page as you and Andy Serling in terms of if you go by the recent past history there, you're really not expecting a DQ. So then I see the head on several times. I was watching the Fox broadcast, which I've said many times, that is such an outstanding broadcast. And they showed it, and then after a while, they were showing it with the lanes. And I mean, look, Vino came out not once, not twice, three times. Was there a bump? No, I wouldn't even ever say there was a bump, but there's light contact. And as you pointed out, Steve, I mean, herding, I loved your comparison in terms of being on the road in your car when the car in the lane next to you starts coming into your lane. What do you do? I mean, because I've used that same analogy a lot of times as a steward myself. And something else, when I've been a steward myself, that I've told jockeys, look, the more you stay straight in a race, and I've told them, in fact, I mean, I told Ruben Fuentes this at Los Alamitos when I was in the stand for the last week of that thoroughbred meet in the summer. I said, Ruben, you're a fine rider. Horses run for you. You've got a great future. But keep in mind when you're out there, the more you can possibly stay straight, the less you're going to be in here seeing the stewards. And the more success you're really going to have, because it doesn't help your business if you're constantly in the steward's office in the morning, and sometimes you're going to be, you know, skate through without a DQ just because in the opinion of the stewards it didn't affect the order of finish, or it didn't deny a horse the opportunity for a better finish, but that you'll be just lucky in that regard. But the more you can stay straight, the less headaches you're going to have, the less headaches are. And I've told many, many riders this for many, many years. So this is the thing about Vino Rosso. The minute he is not staying in his lane, he's putting himself in some jeopardy of possibly being DQ'd. And so to me, my vote would have been for a DQ, and that was my decision before the stewards rendered their decision, and I have to admit, I was a little surprised when they voted for the DQ just because of the recent history of how they've been judging this type of situation in New York. Now, Steve, it seems to me that there has been a change in the personnel recently in this year in the steward stand. You know, we have that vet who has gone into the stand.
Dr. Durenberger.
I think Braulio Baeza, isn't he new? I mean, he's been a steward
he's been there forever. No, he's been there forever.
Okay. One person change can change the dynamic.
There's two.
How stewards rule. And this is why, to me, you know, people constantly are talking, oh, we want consistency, we want consistency. And then I've heard some people in racing, even some commissioners or board members say, you know what, if you keep the same stewards in the stand all the time, they get stale, we should mix them up. Well, Mixing up Stewart's to me is not conducive to consistency. So one thing that you hope for is that you keep kind of a panel of stewards on a consistent basis and hope that those stewards will be consistent. Now, the way they ruled this race, Steve, the hope would be, as you've articulated, that they now continue to judge races similar to this one when they get a similar situation. In other words, if we get another one of these herding deals, one would hope that the number would come down again. But again, it's got to be a close finish. I mean, the margin here was, only a nose, and that's a big element in this decision. If it had been two lengths or something, I doubt they would have taken Vino Rosso down. But when it's a nose, and that was enough of an incident throughout really the entire stretch, when you think about it. I mean, from where they started at the top of the stretch to the finish. So I agree with the DQ, and I'm with you, Steve, and with Andy. I think it is in the best interest of racing to judge races in terms of when you get these horses drifting like that, and to take those numbers down more often than not.
Yeah, if they're going to do it, if they're going to do it consistently, and also beyond the consistency of the decisions when it gets into their hands, I don't understand why they've gotten away. And Rich Migliori has discussed this too, because Mig for a while had been drafted to work with the young riders, but I do not know why the film patrol concept, why that has, has been kind of, I don't know if it's been abandoned per se, but the opportunity to sit with riders and say to them, you guys have got to stop this, and we're going to start calling it on a regular basis. So you might as well hold your lane now, and because you can do it. We understand the heat of the battle, and going, a little bit too much with one hand or another, it can drive a horse in a direction. I mean, frankly, it seemed as if Arad had let up with the left hand, if he had just gotten back to riding, he might have been fine. But he after the first contact, he went back left-handed at least one more time, maybe twice. And I think that was probably what flagged the stewards to say this was more than just a casual bump. He carried him, two and a half pads. I'm a little surprised that the people who are continuing to say that Vino Rosso never should have come down. That's a little hyperbole, basically, as to what transpired there. But if they're going to do it regularly, I think it'd be great for everybody involved. John,
well, if I was a steward there right now, coming off of this incident, and with, we'll call it the controversial aspect of this, because it's a major race, and obviously it's been on social media and so forth, as well as in the regular media. What I would advocate to my two colleagues would be, what we should do is this, the next day we have racing, we should go into the jocks room, have a meeting with these jockeys, and explain our thinking on that particular race. But more importantly, going forward, ladies and gentlemen, this is what the policy is going to be. And when you do what Vino Rosso did, you can expect a very good chance your number is coming down. In other words, the communication element of this, and I'm a big proponent of this. In other words, you don't just sit back. I've always been a proactive steward. This is one thing I disagreed with Bernie Hedl, who was a longtime steward and was a steward for many Kentucky Derbies. But a draw for a Kentucky Derby that was basically done by Chris Lincoln, that television broadcaster, got all messed up, and they were saying, well, gee, that's a shame that happened. And Bernie Hedl said, yeah, it's a shame, because we as stewards, my feeling is we address problems when they get dumped in our lap. I'm not of that ilk. If there's any kind of problem I can nip in the bud before it gets to my lap, I do it. And you know, I'm always after the safety of racing. You know, when I was a steward the first time at Yakima Meadows in 1979, at the age of 24, the first week of the meet was during the fair, and they had a big Ferris wheel to the north side of the grandstand, not too far from the track. And I was starting to see a number of horses during a race, kind of, it looked to me like maybe they were reacting to that Ferris wheel. But I thought, well, I don't know. But instead of just, you know, dismissing it or waiting for an accident to happen, I went down to the jockey's room the next day, and I talked to, like, 10 jockeys. And I said, are you having any kind of problems, you know, turning for home? And I didn't say why, because I wanted to know if they would say, you know what, I think that Ferris wheel, if it's going, you know. So I didn't tip my hand. I wanted to see what they would say. And I'd say probably half of them said, you know, I sure wish they could get that Ferris wheel to not be running during a race. And I said, I will look into it and try to get that stopped. And I called the general manager that day and said, who is Paul George, and I said, Paul, is there a way you can get in contact with the general manager of the fair and set up a deal to where they're aware of when we're running a race and they stop that Ferris wheel? And he said, I'll look into it, and it got done. That's where I say a lot of times just being proactive, you can really help racing that way. And so if I, like I say, if I was in New York, I would be down there not talking to just these riders that were involved in the Gold Cup, but the entire colony, to try to let them know where you stand on what you're going to do. And that at least is a step in the right direction for consistency.
Yeah, well, we'll watch, and they'll be as soon as tomorrow, there'll be opportunities, undoubtedly, to see if you know, what direction things go. John, let's get a couple of minutes in. I got Jeremy Plonk to follow, and haven't had a chance to talk to Jeremy, and I want to get some thoughts from him, particularly on the three-year-old front. But in terms of results out there, particularly in California, we talked to Ganbat yesterday. That was a lot of fun. The Cedillo story was amazing. Phil D'Amato with a huge weekend. Baffert reestablishes the dominance on the two-year-old front. John Sheriff's this morning, Paradise Woods. That was a very important performance from her. Some thoughts about the weekend, the first 3 days of racing at Santa Anita this fall.
Well, you mentioned Amir Cedillo. That's a huge story. What he has done is absolutely extraordinary, really, and much credit goes to his agent, Tom Knutz. He kind of talent scouted him from Northern California, and boy, have they made a splash here in Southern California. And boy, the future just couldn't look more bright for Cedillo at this point. You mentioned Paradise Woods. I've got to say, Steve, I don't know if there's another female thoroughbred that I've ever seen during my lifetime that is as talented but as inconsistent as Paradise Woods. Because one minute she looks like she's unbeatable, and the next minute you can't find her with a search warrant. I mean, she is so up and down. And for two of the best trainers of my lifetime, in Richard Mandela and John Sheriffs. And by the way, I just absolutely loved your interview with Sheriffs today. He is so smart. He's such a sharp individual, so laid back, but he's kind of deceptive that way. And there, I don't know if I've ever enjoyed any more talking to a trainer in my life than John Sheriffs. So just quiet mornings or just when we've ever had conversations. In a way, he's reminded me of another trainer. I think there were a lot of similarities that trained in Southern California in the early 1980s, a trainer by the name of John Gosden. Very similar, very smart people, and very outstanding horsemen. And, of course, Gosden this weekend will be trying to make history with a Nabel, going for an unprecedented third arc, and so I'm really excited about that. By the way, one other thing, in your conversation with Sheriffs, he was talking about one of his horses, and he had mentioned the height of being 15'3", and I had to chuckle because it brought back some memories to me back when I was on the beat as a correspondent for the Racing Form at Tracks in the Pacific Northwest, and I was very a student of conformation and horses, their physicality. Charles Hatton of the Racing Form had really inspired that in me. And in fact, I got the state veterinarian many mornings. I got a tape measure. We actually measured a lot of the stakes horses in the Pacific Northwest, as Dr. Manny Gilman did with the horses in New York with those measurements that would go in the American Racing Manual. But I would ask a lot of trainers, how tall do you think so-and-so is? And I knew I was dealing with maybe not the top trainers that we have in the game, when sometimes the trainer would say, you know, this horse isn't very tall. I'd say maybe 15'4". And I'd be thinking, 15'4"? There is no 15'4". You're 16 when you're... So that was just where it kind of surprised me how many times that I would run into these trainers. Oh, I'd say he's 15'4". And I have to say, when I ended up in Southern California and was talking to the trainers, I never did get any of these guys at San Anita, Hollywood Park, or Del Mar, or even Fairplex, if I said, how tall do you think that horse is? I never did get any 15'4s.
John, a couple of thoughts here beyond the filly. She was terrific. We talked to Phil D'Amato and went through his three winners, Pee Wee Reese and Mirth, and of course Cleopatra's Strike and the John Henry that ran down his own acclimate, who, you know, did figure to be loose out up front. You know, I thought it was nice to get a couple of new, you know, fairly new faces in Mirth and Cleopatra's Strike into the winner's circle.
Well, as Rick Hammerly mentioned on your show, our male turf ranks here in Southern California this year are not the strongest we've ever seen, to say the least, which is one of the reasons I made Cleopatra Strike 7-2 on the morning line. I thought this horse was coming in good form. A lot of times the D'Amato horses get bet, and I was really shocked when the price was 9-1 on this horse. So, and it's funny, as a morning line maker, if I make a horse 8 or 10-1 and they get bet down to 7-2, you'd think I'd killed somebody's mother or something. I mean, the way you get the negative reaction to something like that. But if you make a horse 7-2 and they go off at 9-1, you basically hear crickets. You don't hear very much on that side of the fence, which is just kind of the nature of things these days. There's so much negativity around. But I also thought, you know, we had a very impressive 2-year-old filly win. This Donna Veloci, I mean, this Uncle Mo filly could be anything for Simon Callahan, and they're thinking Breeders' Cup with her, and boy, I don't blame them, because there's no real slam dunks in that division at this point, and even though she'd go in with only the one sprint race under her belt, that was an eye-popping performance there, and then Callahan came back with great power, this Blaine colt, and I think he looks like he's very good, too. He defeated Thunder Code, and who is, I think, a very nice sort in himself, and Baffert had a couple in there. So this great power is really one to watch going forward. And then, you know, Mongolian Groom, I had mentioned earlier this year to you, in fact, after the Pacific Classic, I said, gee, you know, this is a pretty good accomplishment for this son of Hightail, to have finished third in the Santa Anita Handicap and a third in the Pacific Classic. So now you can say he's finished third in the Santa Anita Handicap, third in the Pacific Classic, and he won the Awesome again with that 110 buyer. So really just a great training job by Gambat. And, you know, this is a son of a Breeders' Cup winner and an historic Breeders' Cup winner at that. Hightail won the very first Breeders' Cup juvenile sprint. There were only two of them. And that was D. Wayne Lucas, and that Hightail became the first maiden to ever win a Breeders' Cup race.
Absolutely, it's a big, you know, it's an interesting story. The Hightail, you know, for a horse to win at and compete at these distances. I thought, listen, I made it clear that I liked him when he came to New York. I thought he would absolutely love a tighter surface as opposed to what he had been running over at Del Mar. And it was interesting that Gambat actually addressed that and said the opposite, that was really true, that he likes a deep kind of a beachy surface. So Mongolian Groom, we'll see where that story goes. And I'm glad you mentioned Donna Veloce, who we had heard from Simon Callahan about, earlier in the year. And absolutely looked spectacular, got a 90-plus buyer for the effort. So
I wanted to mention, too, I think a horse to really keep an eye on in the Breeders' Cup Classic coming out of the Awesome again is Higher Power, because I think that stumbling at the start kind of threw him right off his game right there. That Pacific Classic, I would not be surprised if Higher Power kind of rebounds off of that Awesome again and runs a very big race in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I'm kind of getting the feeling about that. And I know Pratt was not in any way, shape, or form dismayed by the performance by Higher Power in the Awesome again, in the context of all that happened in that race. So it's not like he stunk up the joint. He got a 99 buyer out of that. So he almost got a triple digit anyway. But the mile and a quarter, I think, is a big key for him, getting back to that mile and a quarter. And look, he was in the Gold Cup earlier this year, and that's a thing that I think Vino Rosso, I had mentioned to you, he was the one I was kind of excited about. I thought he was very intriguing for the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and look, he ran a heck of a race there.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, I think, really coming to hand here as a Curlin, and that's one of those things I always have started to look for with these Curlins, because they often really do get better as they get older, and he's got that mile and a quarter to me that is a big key. You know, people make such a big deal out of the mile and a quarter for the Kentucky Derby, and they don't make as big a deal about it, in these other races. It's still a big deal. Who is a true mile and a quarter horse is very, very important.
Yeah, and the fact that he came out there and won over the surface.
That's,
I mean,
right.
That part of that absolutely figures, and he'll get his chance for redemption. And I'll be very intrigued to see where he stacks up on the betting front. John, we got a big weekend coming, so we'll watch for the draw tomorrow, the sprint championship, and of course you got Chancelot out there, and everybody waiting for Omaha Beach to run back. We'll have the City of Hope and the LA Woman as well, and more. We'll talk to you next week.
Well, that Omaha Beach workout the other day was, to me, of the hundreds of videos of workouts I've looked at this year, if I were to rank them, that would be number one. That was the most impressive workout I've seen by any horse on video this year. Now, Chancelot came back with a very sharp drill here a couple of days after that. He's going to be extremely tough because he's got the racing. You know, he's been racing. And he, 121 buyer, I'll tell you how tough he can be. But Omaha Beach, is that work was just absolutely, to me, breathtaking, what he did in that work. So at least to me, that was a real huge sign that the Omaha Beach at least is definitely back now. And he is an exciting colt. I really felt he had a shot maybe to even be a Triple Crown winner this year. I thought he was that talented and that game. He had a good combination of talent plus gameness going in, I thought, to the Kentucky Derby. And based on what happened in the Kentucky Derby, look, I think it was kind of ripe there if the Omaha Beach that I think he is would have been able to participate. But that's all, speculation. But as I say, what isn't speculation to me is how outstanding that workout was the other day. It was just, like I say, it was the best workout of video I personally have seen this year.
Well, he'll have his hands full with Chancelot.
No doubt
we'll see
about
who
it.
Else
he,
lines
for
up.
For this race, there. He definitely, I mean, look, I've already pretty much decided I don't see how I could possibly make Omaha Beach favorite over Chancelot, so I'm not. Chancelot will be the favorite, he should win, quite honestly. But I'll tell you one thing, don't underestimate the talent of this Omaha Beach, and don't forget what happened when they shortened him up to 7 furlongs on that sloppy track, because I thought until then he was kind of one of these professional maidens that you know, he didn't really want to win too much. And that was the light switch race that day right there, where he took his game to a higher level. And what he did subsequent to that maiden win verified what I felt out of the maiden win.
Sure.
So, I mean, he is, to me, the real deal. But as you point out, I mean, Chancelot is just, he's, you know, he's going to be pounded in the wagering. He should be. And he's going to be extremely, you know, tough to beat, to say the least. So, but I'm very excited just to get Omaha Beach back on the stage.
Well, we'll look forward to it. We'll talk next week. Jeremy Plonk is with us, too. And we'll talk to Jeremy to the top of the hour. And, Jeremy, good morning. I've been trying to slip you in here the last, I don't know, the last 3, 4, 5 weeks. How are you? Oh, maybe he's not there. There he is. Jeremy.
Hey, good morning.
I thought I said goodbye to John 5 minutes ago, but it to no avail. how you been? I tried to get to you as the start of the night school fall season got started. How was the rest of your summer since we spoke last?
Well, good. We had a kitchen renovation, so our place was ripped up and contractors and banging and clanging here. But the kitchen is sparkling and finished now, and it's quiet enough to get in a show with you and enjoy a visit. So all is well here. And, hey, it's the Tuesday before opening day at Keenan, which means I'm hitting refresh 100 times a minute, looking for that overnight for opening day Friday at Keeneland. So a lot going on, a lot of fun stuff. We started the Express Bet First Call podcast last week with Jeff Siegel, and we'll put that out each Thursday here to 4. And a lot of fun stuff happening. It's that time of year where we make the pivot to fall, and these Breeders' Cup preps last week certainly didn't disappoint. We got another good week of them coming up.
Well, and tell everybody, I'm glad you mentioned Keeneland, because you know, the work that you do is really exceptional. What are the options? And also, of course, Horse Player Now, you'll have plenty of Keeneland coverage. Tell everybody what you got.
Yes, the 23rd meet going back to fall 2008 that I've worked with Keeneland, so I'm very proud of that association. And we'll have the picks for the Keeneland website and their handicapper's consensus, and then in the expert selections part of the website, which I'm told is one of the most popular web parts of the Keeneland website, which is really flattering to hear that from the tech folks there, that a lot of folks do check out the selections and the stats and the trends that we put out there. So every day we'll have the stats and trends for every race at Keeneland, as we have for the last 22 plus meets. And you can go to the expert selections page at Keeneland.com and get that. Kate and Bradar and I will do a daily podcast. Instead of doing the 30-minute preview, we started in the spring, breaking it up into each individual race. So if you join us in the fourth race, you just kind of jump in and listen to the fourth through the rest of the card, that sort of thing. So we do 10 individual race podcasts on a 10-race card, one for each on the card. You can pick those up at the live racing page at Keeneland. Also follow us on Spreaker. The Twitter handles at BetKeeneland is a great place to pick up that information, and Keeneland Racing as well as at Horse Player Now. So Kate and I will preview every race of the meet with a preview podcast. We'll have the stats and trends, the top three picks in each race in the consensus grid, and on the TV graphics as well. You know, when you watch the simulcast feed at Keeneland, they also reposition the picks there. So a lot going on to handicap the Keeneland cards. And, you know, I just love it because, you know, there is something about a start and an end to something that, for me personally, and maybe there are other handicappers and horse players in the same boat, to know that there's a start and an end to something is really intriguing and something that you want to attack. It doesn't have this never-ending flow to it, you know. Your professional horse players and the people who are in it for the grind and the percentage and the rebate and all that, they tell you there's no start, there's no end. The first today is the same as the last tomorrow, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, when you can just look and line up and say, I've got 17 days of the fall, I'm going to get after it, you're even going to get worn out after 4 weeks of handicapping intensely. But I love it. It's one of those kind of things that puts a bounce in your step, and it leads you right into the Breeders' Cup. So it's a fun time of year in October. College football is going well. So for me, my two passions in life outside of my family, college football and horse racing, it doesn't get much better than the month of October.
Well, give us some thoughts, too, in advance here of the next big weekend of BC preps. And as you mentioned, and Andy also, Andy Serling referred to the early PPs, the early overnight that'll be out literally any minute from Keeneland. But what did you think of going back to the Pennsylvania Derby, actually, mm-hmm. where's our 3-year-old group in your mind with Code of Honor having run and having been elevated? And even if he had gotten beat on the square by Vino Rosso, it wouldn't have taken away from, you know, from his luster at right. this point of the year. Give us your overview, Jeremy, as we, you know, kind of fill in the blanks on the fields for British Cup.
Well, for the 3-year-old picture, it really all comes down to what you make of the result in the Kentucky Derby, right? I mean, if you put an eraser to it and treat Maximum Security like he was the 17th place finisher where he was placed, then the 3-year-old title, I think, clearly goes to Code of Honor now. I mean, you can't argue that the two races he put together, the Travers and then beating older horses in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, doesn't trump the victories in the Florida Derby and the Haskell. I think Travers, Haskell are about equal. And then when you look Florida Derby compared straight up with the Jockey Club Gold Cup, you have to say the older horses, the edge. And, of course, you had the on-the-board finish for Code of Honor in the Kentucky Derby. But if you think that the result under the wire of the Kentucky Derby is more indicative of the year and the horses that we're discussing, then you're looking at a trifecta for Maximum Security that nobody can top when you look at the Florida Derby, Kentucky Derby, and Haskell. He's got three majors in there. So that really, it comes down to your interpretation of a horse's resume based on the official placing or what happened on the racetrack. I couldn't argue with somebody who went either direction on it. Now, you know, with the way the result turned out in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, I thought Code of Honor ran well enough that if you wanted to make him the champion 3-year-old, I have no argument with that. But if you go back to Maximum Security, I wouldn't argue with that either. Two horse race.
Well, some of the other performances, and fold in, you know, McKinsey chasing home Mongolian Groom. I don't think, you know, I know Baffert was disappointed, but I think, you know, when you look back and you see the kind of fig that Mongolian Groom and McKinsey posted. McKinsey got a 108 buyer out of that runner-up performance. They both ran, you know, ran well. What does it do to our classic picture?
Well, the classic is, you know, not what we're used to seeing in the last several years. You know, we've had some really good older horses that have kind of stepped up in the division and been pretty solid favorites. I mean, you know, four straight classic winners have been 5-2 or less on the tote board, and that's the longest stretch we've ever seen in the Breeders' Cup Classic of horses that short in price. We've only ever saw three straight horses of that kind of low price and single digits win in the Breeders' Cup. That was 87-89. So like the Kentucky Derby, where the favorites are rolling and dominating the Kentucky Derby in the last couple of years, we're also seeing the dominance of favorites in the Breeders' Cup Classic that never has been seen in the 35 years of that race. But this year has that kind of feel of, yeah, who's going to be the favorite first off, you know? And then secondly, why can't you shop for a price in this Breeders' Cup Classic group? I think we're going to end up with some hodgepodge horses. It's kind of going to be back in the, you know, back in the days when the Breeders' Cup was 7 and 8 races total. You didn't have so many of those intermingling divisions. I think you're going to get a couple of these horses that show up in the Classic that may play somewhere else most years. But in this year's Breeders' Cup, you could have, let's say, a late. You could have, you know, why not Matoli? I put that on Twitter a couple days ago even. You know, the best miler. He won the best race in America this year at a mile. Is this the year that somebody like that says, why not go for the big price and the big purse in the Breeders' Cup? You know, there's, you know, maybe a turfer or something like that. Certainly the Europeans, I know early in your show you guys were talking about that, you know, maybe a turfer or two from Europe, but nobody there, like name-wise, is necessarily standing up as a horse who would be the one from Europe to come over and win in America. But, hey, it's Santa Anita. Europeans have done well on the main track in the Classic, so maybe somebody who's off-Broadway in Europe can be good enough to win this year in the Classic. You know, it's Where Our Kong won. We've seen Taste of New York run really well, Declaration of War. These horses have run pretty well on the main track of Santa Anita from Europe. Maybe this is the year. It just feels like kind of an oddball year. I'd be surprised if it is like McKenzie, you know, who rebounds and wins. John threw out, you know, the horse from the Pacific Classic who had higher power, who, you know, didn't have the best of trips in the Awesome again. He could rebound and win it, and that would give John Sadler back-to-back wins in the Classic. But I'm fishing right now, Steve. I'm looking for something a little off the wall in the Classic division.
Well, that makes me think to mention that because I got the email, or at least I found the email yesterday, this morning when I woke up early. We've got the ExpressBet Breeders' Cup wagering guide, and it'll have all the races covered, plus added bonus coverage, Eddie Olczyk and Brett Musburger, Johnny D. I'm doing the classic for about, I don't know, maybe the fourth year in a row, fifth year in a row, and it's always one of the, for me, you work hard to try to give people ammunition going into all of these races, and the Friday before, we should be ready to introduce, right? So 2 weeks from, oh my God, 2 weeks, 3 weeks from Friday.
Yeah, the ExpressBet Wager Guide's always out the week before the Breeders' Cup. We get the pre-entries. We're able to digest things during that week. And then during Breeders' Cup week, we'll be able to update and come in with some updated news and selections. My contribution to it, I'm looking right now at a stack of 17 pages of stats and trends that I've put together. I'm final proofing those and getting those ready for the layout folks now. Production on that guide starts this week. And again, in the next couple weeks, the handicappers will come in. A field of 14 handicappers for the 14 different races. And then we've got Eddie O and Brett Musburger on the also eligible list as well with their analysis that will chime in on the additional classic coverage. So 16 handicappers over the 14 divisions. A lot of really good information in that. And it's the price that's right. It's free. Just go to ExpressBet.com and download it. And we'd love to see you as a wagering customer there as well. But certainly a lot going on in the content section of ExpressBet, and I'm really happy to contribute to that with, again, Jeff and I's podcast on Thursdays, ExpressBet First Call, and the wager guide coming up. A lot of really good stuff and content there that you can check out.
Well, and the night school segments, and I see that we got some pick six conversation tonight, right?
Yeah, and it kind of dovetailed. We did pick six years ago in night school, but that was kind of before the advent of this rainbow jackpot single solo ticket pick six. So the conversation changes up a little bit and some approaches to that. And certainly one of the suggestions we have in the night school that you'll hear tonight is to try to get in a day or two before those mandatory payout days. Because that's a lot of times when we're seeing those things knocked out, just like we saw last week. What, $2 million winner down at Gulfstream Park took it out a couple days before the mandatory payoff. And the pick six is a different beast than it used to be.
Very much. We talked yesterday, in fact, with Johnny, and it was a very different takedown. This was very unusual. The way it happened, the anatomy of it was not. It wasn't like Dan Borislav's takedown and the typical early takedown that happens before the distribution, where you get some 30 and $40 horses. This was really a surprise that somebody and the ticket was a sizable ticket, but not an insane ticket. So, Jeremy, I appreciate this, and I'm glad to connect, and we'll touch base as we lead into Breeders' Cup. Countdown to the Cup.
All right. I was at the dentist this morning, so this was the best part of my day by a mile.
I love it. Jeremy Plonk, everybody. Horse Player Now on Twitter, and, of course, Brian W. Spencer and the whole team. They're just invaluable. And all of the night school archives are there for you to pick and choose and peruse to learn. We'll call it a Tuesday. Look forward to those Keeneland PPs that'll be out early this afternoon. Back tomorrow, Wednesday get together, Sid Fernando, and much, much more. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.